Hi, everyone. Welcome to the 18 Summer Show. We are your hosts, Jim
and Jamie Shields. We're here to help you bring family back.
In the last decade, we've helped thousands of families create the family life that you have always wanted.
We give you simple solutions on how you can ignite your family life and succeed in both business and at home.
And please remember, time is of the essence. You only have 18 summers to truly connect with your children.
So let us help you make the most of it.
Hello, 18 Summers Tribe. We're here today between the two of us and Dr. Kelly Flanagan. What a treat. We got to meet Dr. Kelly through our good friend, Ken Wimberly, who was on here previously, Legacy of Love app. Yes. And he knew that we would naturally become great friends with Dr. Kelly and that we would connect over our core values. Dr. Kelly helps families, relationships, deepen, strengthen, guiding them through the three essentials of truly satisfying life, some of which we talk about ourselves. Purpose is just so huge and strong. So I know that you've been published in Reader's Digest. You've been on the Today Show.
Your daughter was on the Today Show.
Right. I'd love to hear that story. Yeah, for sure. But welcome. Thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, thanks for having me here. I just feel so blessed to get to come on and have a conversation with two people who are so centered in themselves and with their family. It's a blessing.
Ditto, Dr. Kelly. And I think as we were getting to know each other, I know we have a bunch of things we're going to go over, but you being a clinical psychologist, which I think is super important right now, obviously this is an essential and something Jamie and I believe deeply in. I like how you set yourself apart, which you explained to us, where most clinical psychologists are taught not to share personal things. And years ago, you started blogging about the unperfect family life you were probably living in yourself and that. And it sounds like you created relatability, but what made you do that? I mean, that's a big step.
Well, that's a good question. And actually, so when I started the blog in 2012, it started more as just a way for me to sort of share my clinical expertise and like kind of let people know that I'm out there. But I fell in love with writing really quickly. And it began to gradually drift into, I mean, I always looked at it through the lens of, I'm only going to write something if it's helpful to my clients. But I started to drift more into personal territory and sharing more personally through my blog. My colleagues thought I was crazy because, yeah, you're trained in psychology graduate school to share very little. But then I started to have my clients come into me and say things like, hey, I was never going to tell you this, but I read on your blog that you went through something similar. And so, and it just started to sort of snowball to the point where I realized that by setting myself apart as some sort of professional that has it all together, I was actually hindering the growth and healing process of my clients because I wasn't as safe of a space to come in and talk about all the mess, right? So now people know most of my junk. And I think that's the way that I want to live and how I want to show up as a healer, hopefully.
And does your writing not only inspire others, but do you feel through that catharsis of writing, healing yourself?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I mean, I think I hesitate to say this sometimes because I think it come off as a little narcissistic, but like my book Lovable, I go back and read it sometimes because I need to read it. You know, like, and I'll read a passage and I'll get moved by it. And it's like, I don't remember writing that, but thank goodness I did because I needed to hear it today, you know? So yeah, absolutely. The writing is as much about me. It's my form of prayer, my meditation. It's me sort of sorting through my own stuff and trying to find something redemptive in it so that I can go back to later and be reminded of what I need to hear.
Yeah. And I love that you said that going back to read, because I don't think there's ego in that at all. I think it's just trying to reconnect and reground. I know that old journals sometimes, right. When I was, you know, when we went through tough 08, you know, almost nearly going bankrupt, I remember going back and looking at dates earlier I had written in my journal and going, okay, wow, that was a small problem I was dealing with. Or that was a big one I went through. But, you know, that kind of that markering of, it just regrounds you. It gives you a recentering for sure.
Yep. And that's a great way to put it. I never actually thought about it like that. But it really is. A lot of my writing is my life. And so I get to go back and read it and learn from it all over again, right?
Now you referenced your book, Lovable, and that was your first book. And you have another one coming out, True Companions. One thing that struck me was talking about prioritizing your companions.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about what you mean by that?
So there's several ways in the book I talk about that, but most distinctly, I talk about a line of research from a Stanford psychologist named Laura Carstensen. And I came across this research in a great book called Being Mortal. And what she did was she explored the idea, you know, we look at young people and young people tend to be, they spread themselves out pretty thin. They're meeting new people. They're trying new things. They're accumulating stuff. And then you look at the more elderly and it seems like they've gotten more centered. Like they're focused on their companions. Their values are around ordinary everyday pleasures and deeper connection with the people they already know. So she wanted to explore this idea and say, is it really age? Is it just, is it hopeless? Like until we're older, we're never really going to get our priorities straight. And what she found was that it isn't age that matters, it's perspective. That when as human beings, we're aware that our time is short, our values automatically shift to the values of the elderly. We start to care more about ordinary pleasures and spending time with our companions and deepening those connections. And she did one really interesting study where she brought, I think it was 8 to 93 was the age range. And she brought these people in the lab and she just had them go through like a mental experiment. She said, okay, so imagine that you are about to move to a distant place and you'll never see your people again. How will you spend the next 6 months of your life, say? And they all talked about even the young people, they describe the values of the elderly, that they would focus on their people and then just soaking up every moment. But then she did a second condition and she had all of them go through this. And she said, now imagine you've been given a bonus 30 years to live. What would you do with the next 6 months of your life? And the elderly people said, I would start a new career. I'd make more money. I'd go experience this. I'd meet new people. And so she showed through this study that it doesn't matter how old you are. If your perspective is that you've got all sorts of time, right? Then you're going to act like the young tend to act in terms of priorities around companionship. And if you're aware that your time is fleeting, then you're going to take the perspective more of the elderly and value your people, which is why I love what you're doing so much. Like you're keeping that in front of people all the time. Like at most, your horizon is 18 summers out, right? And that's going to come really fast. And by doing that, you're actually like, you're rewiring people's perspectives to focus on what matters for their companions. I just think it's beautiful what you're doing.
And that means a lot, especially coming from you. And this is a simple math equation that's all we wanted to do was put some awareness and positive motivation on the time we have. And we get this sometimes, the occasional argument, well, there's more than 18 summers. There's this. We've even seen.
If you do the first 18, right?
Yeah. So if you do the first 18, we've seen you have more than that. Yeah. And arguing articles from some big groups. And we said it was all about raising awareness. That's all it is. And the science shows, you know, once they hit the age of 18, it was almost 85% of all the quality time you'll ever get. I think that can be extended. Wow. Why ignore those statistics, right? I mean, like you were just realizing, and that's been our whole mission.
Yeah, with a 17-year-old now, it feels almost like it was 16 summers because he's got his license now, so he's got more independence.
Yeah, we have a 17-year-old as well, and there's that independence now, and there's that, and we're lucky that he does want to hang out with us.
Right.
But it's very different from when he was seven. Let's be honest. It's very different. So it's that making the most of the time we've got.
You got it. I love that you're doing that. Thank you for that.
And now, speaking of our teenagers, because we both have a 17-year-old, let's talk about, I think you had said, the unique challenge in the teenage years. Mm. I don't think there's a little bit of unique opportunity in there too.
I think, yes,
yeah.
There is. In any challenge, there is opportunity. Yeah, I mean, I find that when I used to joke, like, I would get a call from a parent and say, I just don't know what to do with my teenage son. Yet, you know, he's rebelling. We were getting in fights all the time. And I would always say, like, is he like in the spring of his senior year? And they're like, yeah, like, I think I might know what's going on. And the idea is that as that horizon approaches for us as parents, you know, we become nostalgic for that time we had with them when they were seven, you know, that was this had a totally different quality to it and more of a quantity to it. And so we start to do more of that sort of holding on or trying to make the most of. We want to spend as much time with them as possible when they're 17 and 18. They see that horizon, and this isn't an end for them. This is a beginning, right? And beginning horizons make you want to go after it, seek it, go after adventure, expand yourself. And so you're in an entirely different emotional place. And when you don't realize this, parents, and unfortunately, you can end up spending these last couple of years of the time that your child is at home butting heads, right? You wanting to go backward, them wanting to move forward. So I do think the opportunity in that is to sit down and have a conversation about that. Ideally over something yummy and sweet, because teenagers always interact better when it comes to good food. Right. Right. But, you know, this, you know, sitting down and just, you know, sitting down with the teenager and saying, you know, can we have space where I can tell you what I loved about having you here in our lives, the way that we did for so long? And then can we have space where you talk about what you're excited about and scared about with leaving and what's coming up next? And can we talk about, can we reach a shared understanding of what does companionship look like for us going forward? As you leave, you know, companionship, it's not ending, it's evolving and it's changing and it's transforming. So what will our companionship look like when you're off at college, when you get your new job? Because we still want to have that companionship with you to just be different. And do that over a monthly breakfast, you know, for the last couple of years that they're home or, you know, whatever they decide that they want to do. I think that's a great way to seek the opportunity in it.
Well, that's powerful.
That's huge. And we talk a lot about setting expectations, like boundaries and expectations with your spouse or with your children. But I have wondered, how do we navigate? And that's such a great way to ask really what you're asking in that question. Like, what does companionship look like to you? You know, what's it going to look like to us once you're gone? Essentially, we're saying we need to set some boundaries and expectations, but that's in a way, and yeah, they're going to respond a lot better because I know our team, he jokes sometimes, like, you're going to miss me when I'm gone. I'm like, you're going to miss me when you're gone. And so, you know, that's our boundaries and expectations. I'm going to miss you and you're going to miss me. And we both know it. And let's just stop there. So I like that conversation.
Yeah, I've never heard that before.
That's a beautiful dance that you're doing with your teenager there, just sort of kind of acknowledging what's coming and naming the good things. I know this hit me for the first time when our oldest Aiden, which is right now over a year ago, got his license, right? And my wife called up and said, I'm going to take him to get his license. It was the day where I was out of town. I was going to be back in town the next day, which is when I thought he was going to get it. And she said, I'm going to get it for him. We're going to take him and get it for him today. And I said, and I literally said these words, no, don't. I want to be there for his first solo drive. And it hit me. I can't be there for his first solo drive. It's not a solo drive.
Yeah, like, that's like a work.
Oh no. Like all of these milestones that are coming up for him, they're only milestones if I'm not there. Like that is hard. And so what does it look like for me to continue to be his companion when I can't be there for a lot of important stuff or it's not a milestone, right? That's the discussion to have.
Well, and that's a hard walk right now where we're wanting to push from the nest, but still be there.
Yep.
And I think it got more complicated. At least we saw that, and I'm sure you did, for people through these last 9 months. I mean, this is a different channel we're all going through, you know, of how much are we really there? We're there way too much, whether either one of us really wanted that. You know, what have you seen from clients overall? And how are you kind of finding the best roadmaps for people going through that right now?
That's a great question.
Because I do find that we went from having these budding teenagers who are starting to like take the space and starting to drive and starting to have these freedoms to being like, wait, you are going to just be home up my butt all day long, you know, and so it kind of really changed that dynamic. So how are you suggesting, you know, that dynamic, what eases that?
Well, first of all, just a little confession. Our school board voted on Wednesday night, just this week, to send the kids back to school full time at the beginning of January. And I might have done a little bit of a dance for Oliver. I might still be doing it inside because it's not natural. Right? Like some of the give and take of family and companionship is the space that happens between you two. And that home is it's a base from which you launch yourself to go out and try yourself in the world. It's sort of like, it starts out as early as the playground where, you know, if you remember that point where your kids could walk finally and walk away from you in the playground and they would walk away and then they'd look back to make sure you're there. Right. And then they'd look back to make sure you're there. And that's like what our kids are going to do all the way into adulthood. But then all of a sudden this pandemic and quarantine happens and it's like, no, you've got to sit in your parents' lap at the playground all day. That's hard. Like their instinct is to go play on the slides and your instinct is to watch them go do that and enjoy their growth. And it's been paused. So that's been hard, I think, for families. And at the same time, we were talking about before this, there's been a lot of good things in it, that togetherness. The time that we've had that we wouldn't have normally had. But I just think it's important for all parents to know it's okay to also be annoyed and to want them to go again and do their things. Like that's how it's supposed to be.
None of us want to miss out on life. You know, we've all been traumatized through this in various ways.
Right.
And, you know, even though our sons don't attend school physically, our oldest had senior homecoming, like in person.
Yeah.
And we thought, like, there's no way I can't let him go. Like, this is his senior homecoming. Like, bye, have fun. We'll deal with it afterwards, you know, because the idea of him being, I know you speak about this also, the idea of him being lonely and not a part of something that mattered so much that he could have launched into, but to miss it, feel that depth and that loneliness, even though I know you say you can put your loneliness to work for you. I didn't want that for our son.
That's been, you know, I appreciate your thoughtfulness about that. I mean, I think it's crystallizing something. I think, so cultures for most of human history have had rites of passage, you know, clearly defined kind of rituals that helped move you from one stage of developmental growth to another. And we don't have those as intentionally anymore, but we do have them sort of habitually, right? Like senior homecoming, senior proms, graduation ceremonies, and those sorts of things. And there is a deep grief that goes along with missing out on those rites of passage. They're markers for us. We look forward to them most of our lives, and when they're taken away, and some of the belonging that goes along with those, the people we participate in those rites of passage with is taken away, there's a huge grief that goes along with that. And we've been fortunate as a family that our developmentally, all three of our kids, they're not missing any major milestones during this, right? We just got lucky. But I know a family who, they had like three graduations last year that didn't happen, you know, mom and two kids, all were supposed to graduate something. And that's just so hard. So I appreciate you having the sensitivity to name that. We need to get back to our rites of passage, that's for sure.
We're looking forward to it. And I think one of the biggest lessons we learned, and I think Jamie definitely led through that, where at first I was going into more of the hard football coach. Like I could have easily gone into that old football coach, toughen up, you got this, da, da, da. And you almost downplay, but really quick, we caught on like in mid-March, right when this thing happened, like I can't discount what they're going through based out of the eyes of a 46-year-old for a 15, 17-year-old, because I'm looking through it at 46. But if I looked at, rewinded through my eyes with me at 15, I'm not allowed to see my friends. I can't go to school. I have to be here. Like I would have been mortified. I've been like, wait, what? And that's been a really important thing. We've tried to do work with a lot of families saying, don't discount what each person's going through, especially for us entrepreneurs. Yeah. There's a bad thing. And I would be the most guilty saying, well, don't you understand? I'm navigating two businesses through this unknown time in this. And it's you pedestal your experience and you push down everyone else's experience.
Which, absolutely.
Yeah. You know, and that, we've really tried to navigate that better. And all of us respect each other's experience because we're all through different eyes and different, you know, right passages at this point. So
what a powerful message, because that entrepreneurial spirit serves us so well in so many ways. But when you bring it home, sometimes it does not serve us terribly well. I mean, a lot of ways it can, but like what a great job catching yourself wanting to apply that in this situation and going, you know, that my kids can't outwork this situation. They can't outcreate, ingenious the situation. They've just got to learn how to live through it and endure the disappointments. Like that's really hard.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, navigating disappointments and loneliness, like I touched on earlier, like putting those things to work for you. How do you guide your clients through putting disappointment, loneliness, things that we might seem as negative emotions to work for us?
Well, you know, one of the things I talk about in True Companions is I actually, I'll tell a quick story. Is that okay?
We love stories.
Yeah.
Because the word loneliness is a complicated one. And when we say it, it means a lot of different things for a lot of different people. So I like to tell a little story about the importance of clarifying what words we're using. I had this couple who came in once. I'd been seeing them for a while. They've been doing pretty well. And they came in fighting tooth and nails one week. And they were fighting about whether or not to put a new TV in the living room. And I'm like, I'm trying to facilitate their conversation and I'm listening. And all of a sudden it starts to dawn on me. They both mean something different by living room. So I stopped them and I said, could you just stop for a second? Could you describe the living room? You know, and husband starts to describe the living room. And she goes, that's not the living room. That's the family room. And he goes, oh no, that's the living room. She goes, no, that's the family room. I'm fine putting a TV in there. Right. And so when I use the word loneliness with people, I think sometimes I'm describing a different room. Right. And that when people hear the word lonely, they think of a room that is full of abandonment, full of isolation, full of shame. And when I talk about loneliness, I'm talking about that space inside of you where you are totally unique and no one can totally get to it. No one can totally understand it. And we need to learn how to live with that, the loneliness of that, that no one's really going to totally get me, no matter how great my parents are, no matter how great my friends are and companions, like there's one of me. So no one's going to totally get it. And to me, that's the redemptive piece of it, is that when you can get to the center of your loneliness, in that sense, you've gotten to the center of your uniqueness. You've gotten to the center of your power. You've gotten to the center of your strength. But a lot of times we go away from it because it doesn't feel very good. It doesn't feel very good to not be understood. And so that's one example of how I'm trying to help people put hard things like a sense of loneliness to work for them. If we can get you to that, if we can get you to quit avoiding it, there's no limit to what you might do with that space in you.
I like that.
I love that because, of course, I paired the word discouragement or, like something negative, like probably all people do when I hear loneliness, because I don't think of loneliness, your lone self, your lone self.
I went through the same thing. I wrote the first part of this book, True Companions, about loneliness and the importance of being able to know that in a relationship, like in a marriage like you're in, your partner will not be able to take away your loneliness completely. There's just parts of you they won't ever totally get. So don't keep blaming them and fighting them and creating conflict around that. So I wanted to emphasize that in True Companions. But when I took it to my Facebook tribe and I said, hey, loneliness is a good thing, they're all like, you're crazy. And they'd never push back on me really about anything. It made me realize we need to distinguish it from abandonment, shame, isolation, these really disappointment, these really hard human experiences, and clarify that loneliness is the shadow side of our uniqueness. And we just need to know that and own that.
I love that. Well, I'm excited that I get to read your book in February. It comes out in February. It
comes out February 9th. Really exciting. Thank you.
I think I got to read it. It was either the foreword or an excerpt. And so I didn't get the concept of loneliness, but I love that.
I don't think I've ever heard someone take that pressure off of saying there are parts of you that are deep in that are just yours, and no one will understand those completely. And that's okay. I think it's the permission it does take, where it's like,
I feel so much better.
I'm thrilled to hear that. Yeah. And I know you like opportunity. And here's the opportunity in that is that ironically, if one partner can own that and feel the pressure lift and the other partner can own that and feel the pressure lift, now you do have something more in common, which is that you both know you feel lonely. And you can actually talk about the experience of that you'll never totally get this about me. And you can actually share what it's like to feel that. And so ironically, you're a little bit less lonely. But yeah, that's the opportunity. And I'm so happy to hear you have that reaction, because that is the pressure I want to relieve from companions everywhere, is this pressure that the other person remove that completely.
That is a lot of pressure. I've never thought of it like that, but to say, hey, there's probably part of me you won't understand or heard to say that, and that's okay, and me to be comfortable with that and vice versa.
Yep.
Yeah. You're right. It's not discouraging. It's relieving. So
I think society sets us up to think that your soulmate, you'll know everything about them and you'll this and you're connect on every level. And I think people are really discouraged by real life sometimes because we don't have a context of what is real.
One of the toughest things for us, I know you've seen some of our stuff. I think the worst two words ever to be put into the realm that we try to teach in is that saying the perfect family.
Oh,
I think
it's
the worst they have the perfect family. And I say, we would never know how to teach from a point of perfection. Like, I don't know where that came from. I don't know who put those two words together. It's one of the worst things because it holds this standard that, first of all, is not true. First, and secondly, as you taught, you're not relatable. Your clients open up to you more. If our kids heard us saying, we have the perfect family, they'd be like, bullshit. Like, we have...
Or the expectation.
So we always try to say, we are not about the perfect family. We don't like that saying. We're about bridging our imperfections. I love that.
That's a beautiful phrase, bridging our imperfections. I like that. Yep. And so this is a similar concept, bridging our loneliness, right? Just connecting our sense of loneliness and not having to remove it. That's what it's all about. Yeah. I love that. Yeah.
That's one I can already see now. I'm picturing each one of our kids where I'm like, I can know them in pretty deep, but the pool might go to 120 feet and I get to about 97, and that's pretty good. And that's, wow. This is our aha.
I know, it's hard.
Like, Jamie, when she writes the notes, does these stars, there's about 57 stars.
Well, when you said that too, I've never thought about it like this, but when you said that, I thought, and there's sometimes when my teenager, he knows I don't get him completely. And so when I try to pretend like I do, that's actually invalidating to him. He's like, no, you don't fully get me, And I need to know that it's okay that that's true as a dad.
Now, one thing that we have a huge common ground on is purpose, you know, purpose being an essential to a satisfying life. And for us, it goes along your purpose and your passion for us. And we find it matters so much to us that our children, part of that loneliness, as you just defined it for me, I'm like, wow, I feel like my purpose and my passion lives deep in my loneliness. Like it is so stinking deep.
That's it.
That nobody could ever totally get it. And there'll just be shoots of it, you know, the flowers or the branches that you can see from the outside, but that like core of it, you know, ties into what you teach others, the three essentials of a satisfying life. Will you tell us about that?
Yeah, you just got me so excited because like you think about people who are avoiding that lonely space within them and they are saying at the same time, I don't know what my purpose is. Why am I here? It's because you're not going in that space. That's you're right. That's exactly where you encounter that. Worthiness, belonging, and purpose. Yeah, I write about those in Lovable. At some point, I realized that almost always I'm writing about one of those three things. The unique perspective I bring to it is that I see them fitting together, actually, in a particular way, in the sense that, you know, it's not until you've really embraced your worthiness that you can truly begin to find your places of belonging, because places of belonging happen when you feel the comfort with yourself and who you are to actually reveal yourself to people and then look around and go, who thinks I'm okay? You know, who thinks I'm weird, but okay. And then with those places of belonging, you have people who can support you in living out your passion and your purpose. And you just said something really important too that also distracted me because it was so important, which is when it comes to places of belonging and how that supports our purpose, it's way more important for our companions to say, I believe in you than I understand you, right? Because our passion and purpose is probably coming from a place they can't totally understand. But when someone says, I believe in you, you want to go do that thing. I see you light up when you talk about it and you're super excited. I believe in you, go do it. And that's what we need from our companions. And they may not totally get it. My wife thinks I'm crazy to sit around writing in a room by myself all day. She's a huge extrovert, right? She doesn't get it at all, but she believes in me, right?
Yeah.
And that's what we get when we've cultivated those places of belonging, is we get that support to really live out our purpose.
Again, one of my biggest inspirations was for purpose was in your field. The Man's Search for Meaning was just monstrous for me. I mean, Viktor Frankl's work for what he did, and that comes down to the detection of purpose and meaning. And this just brings me back to that. I mean, I've read that book 3 or 4 times at least.
I remember the room I was in the first in the afternoon, the first time I read it, it was a game changer.
Oh, it was unbelievable. So this ties right into it, but takes it also to a better understanding of that. I've never heard the worthiness and belonging coupled with it. So I do really like that. Where I think that's why we're in certain groups that we've met through before and things, because there has to be a belonging.
That's right.
That community is just, that community causes longevity. I mean, that's one of the biggest things they're tying back longevity to right
that's
now.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yep.
So.
Yep.
Now, Dr. Kelly, we always finish each of our interviews with our 75-year-old self question. So a lot of times you hear people say, oh, what would you tell younger Kelly? And, you know, it's like, oh, we'll pay attention now, or, oh, save for later, whatever it may be. But what about your 75-year-old self? What would your older, wiser self?
What advice would he give today, do you think? If you really had to tap in and be honest, what advice he'd give today about, you know, moving forward, where you're at now, what everyone's going through.
Yeah.
What advice do you think that 75-year-old self would give?
So I actually was blessed enough to have this happen to me. I was probably about 34 at the time, maybe 10 years ago. Our church started a mentoring program. And, you know, I'm a young psychologist. I think I'm pretty hot stuff. So they said, come up to the table after church and let us know, you know, if you're interested. So I went up and they said, do you want to be a mentor or a mentee? And I felt like I was slapped across the face. And I just knew instantly, like, I need to be a mentee. I'm only 34. What am I doing being a mentor, you know? And so I was just blessed to be connected to one of the really wise elders in our community, somebody who'd been a dean of students at a local college and was respected. He had, you know, things named after him at the school. So we sit down together for our first mentoring appointment. You know, we go through the whole introductions and everything. And then I'll never forget this. It was life-changing. His name's Sam. I said, Sam, like, what should I be focused on right now? What's the best piece of advice that you can give me? Like, where should my focus be? And he said, Kelly, you'll have plenty of time to save the world after your kids are grown and gone. And if you don't, you've got bigger problems than saving the world. Yeah. And this is a guy who lived it, right? And this was the guy who was supposed to tell me, oh, Kelly, these are all the amazing things you're supposed to do for the world, serve and give and do all this stuff. And of course, I do a lot of that. But his priority was, you know, don't get caught up in the ambition of feeling like you need to save everybody while your main priority should be kind of dialing into your family. And it just, yeah, it recentered me. And I'd say right now, I got Sam in my head about 50% of the time, and 50% of the time I ignore him and I regret it. But, you know, the ebbs and flows, right?
I love that. That is so powerful, especially, I mean, talking about that tying into our 18 summers core values, that's a huge reminder for me. Hey, yep. It's great to help families, but if I'm not with my own family,
you have a much bigger problem.
Am I really living with purpose? Am I really?
Authentic.
That's right. Yeah, because authentic purpose is, you know, it's sustainable, it's balanced, right? And so, yeah, if you feel like somehow your purpose is starting to hijack your main purpose, which is to raise this family, to attend to this family, yeah, that's when you start to have to wonder about it. Who was this? Mother Teresa that said, if you want to save the world, go home and love your family?
Love your family. I love that.
Yeah. So Sam was saying the same thing to me when I was 34.
How great that you learned it at 34 and not 74.
I heard it at 34. I think I'm still learning it.
Still learning it. We all are, right?
Yeah, I think it's day by day, right? I mean, every day we have to consciously choose, like, I want to be here. I want to show up.
That's right.
Love it. Well, how can more people learn about the book? Where can they find out more about you and what you offer?
Yeah. So if people want to hear more about those three essentials and get a 52-week free guide for walking through those three essentials, you can go to my website, drkellyflanagan.com. It's drkellyflanagan.com. Right there in the header, you subscribe to my email list and you'll get that free download. Right now, as far as the book goes, you can go to truecompanionsbook.com to order the book and enter your information for a pre-order bonus that I'm cooking up. And if you're interested in what the pre-order bonus is, you can go to truecompanionsbonus.com and find out more about that.
You're also on Instagram.
Yep. Yeah. Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook are my big spots. All of them under Dr. Kelly Flanagan, Dr. Kelly Flanagan. So you can find me anywhere there.
Thank you so much for being here today and imparting your wisdom. I've got a sheet full of notes. Like I feel like I need to go write a little bit on this loneliness. I want to go tell all of our children, I see you, because I don't completely see you.
Right on.
I see you because I don't totally see you.
It blends right with our we're not perfect.
I love it.
And that's okay. I love that.
Every time I say that, I'm going to try to give you credit for it. I'm going to try to remember, I see you because I don't totally see you. That's so good.
So much, Dr. Kelly. It was wonderful to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Take care.